All right, we're beginning here on the bottom of Kuf Chavav Amud Bet, four lines from the bottom. Amar Rabbi Yami, Tum Tum Shenikra V'Nimtza Zachar Einu Nutel Pishnayim. A Tum Tum who is opened up and found to be a Zachar, he does not get the double portion of the Bechora. So a Tum Tum is an individual born without any discernible gender, but afterwards they are able to surgically open up the body and see they are either male or female. So after the fact, they're able to determine that the individual was a Zachar. But at the time of birth, it was indiscernible. And so now, based on the Pasuk, Gzeret HaKetuv, Damakra, the Pasuk says, Vaya ben HaBechor L'Sniya, Ajay ben Mishat HaVaya, that the ben HaBechor will belong to the woman who he dislikes. And the drusha that the Chazal have over here is that he has to be a ben zachar, mishat havaya, from the moment of his inception. The way that the Rashbam says it, we learn it after the word vehaya. So the word vaya tells you mishat havaya. From the moment that they come into existence, you need to know that they are zachar. If that discovery is only made later on, then they don't qualify for the parsha. The Gzeret HaKetuv is, in order to be a ben abechor, you need to be a bechor, or you need to be a zachar, from the moment of birth. Over here, since this information is only determined after the fact, you're not considered to be a zachar from the moment of birth, and you fail to qualify for the parshat ha-bechor. Now we're going to have some similar dinim that derive from this. From Nachman bar Yitzchak Amar, Afenu nidon ke ben sorer umore. The same thing applies to him vis-a-vis being a ben sorer umore. The ben sorer umore is the next parshia after the parshat ha-bechor in the beginning of parshat Ki Teitze. And over there again it says, Ki Yali Ish Ben Sorer Umore. Rav Nachman Yitzchak makes the same drasha, which is the Pasuk says, Ki Yali Ish Ben Sorer Umore, Ache Ben Mishat Havaya, until he is a Ben Zachar, until he is a male child, from the moment of inception. Again, the word Vahaya is used, or Yiyah is used, to indicate what the Rashbam says is, it has to be from the moment of inception that you know he's a Zachar, otherwise he's not qualified to fit into this parshia. In one case, it's from the positive sense of being the Bechor. The other case is the negative sense that he will not be indicted as a ben sorer umoreh. Ameymar amar, af enu mimayit chelek bechora. So Ameymar says that he also does not reduce the portion of the Bechora. Shinemar, because the Pasuk says, ve'yaldu lo banim. So it says, ki tiyan ali ish tei nashim, achat ahuva v'achat snua, ve'yaldu lo banim, ahuva v'asnua. So they gave birth to children, and the older child was to the disliked wife. So over here again, he's darshaning from the context of the pasuk, which is v'yaldudo banim, is in the context of v'ya ben abechor l'sniya. So that the bechor, which is v'haya, from the moment of havaya, then the yaldudo banim, the children that are born, also have to be from that same time period, I mean from inception. So only somebody who is a zachar from inception has impact on the bechor. Ajay ben bishat leida. If not, he doesn't have an impact on the bechor. So for example, if you have Yerusha that comes to three brothers consist of a bechor, a pashut, and a tumtum. You have the assets of the estate divided into nine portions. So normally, if you had three brothers here, and you have a bechor, you would divide the nine by four, and then you would give two portions of that to the Bechor. He would get 4.5. And the other two brothers would split the remaining 4.5, which is that they would get 2.25 each. That's the normal way to do the distribution. In this instance, since the Tumtum does not count towards the Chelek HaBechorah, what you do up front is you say, there are only two brothers over here. The Tumtum doesn't count. The Bechor and the Pashut, we leave out the Tumtum. So now the Bechor and the Pashut, normally in a situation like that, you would take the estate, divide it in three. Two-thirds of it would go to the Bechor. One-third would go to the Pashut. So in our situation, with nine portions, two-thirds would go to the Bechor. Six of those portions would go to the Bechor. The other three would belong to the Pashut. So what we say is that the Chelek HaBechorah is worth three. So the Bechor keeps those three. The remaining six now, they go back and redivide amongst the three brothers. The Bechor, the Pashut, and the Tumtum. So they'll each get two of that. So that means that the Bechor in totality will get five, the Pashut will get two, and the Tumtum will get two. And in that way, the division of the Bechorah is done independent of the Tumtum. It's as if he doesn't exist. the distribution of the assets in the division of the Pshutim, meaning that non-Chelek HaBechura is divided evenly between the three brothers. In all these cases here, the situation is that he was born a Tumtum, and they later discover that he is a Zachar. If he's not a Zachar, then none of this matters, because there's no Din of Bechor, there's no Din of Ben Sorer or Moreh, and there's also no Din of Chalukah in the Yerusha if there are other brothers, if the individual is not a male. If it's a female, then there's no reason even to worry about them, because they're outside the Parshia of Yerusha, at least if there are brothers that are available to take the Yerusha. There is no logic behind this. These are all learned out from Sukkim, Gzerat HaKatuv, of Havaya. At the moment of inception, you have to know they are Zachar. If you don't know that, they're just not qualified for this Parshia. It's not a logical argument. It's not because we aren't certain. It just has to do with the fact that we didn't know at that moment, and the Torah requires that you know at that moment, and it fails that test based on the Gzerat HaKatuv. So in this instance, you have the Chelek HaBechura not being affected by the Tumtum, whereas the Chelek HaPashut is affected by the Tumtum, or in essence, the Tumtum causes the Bechor to take more because of his Chelek HaBechura and hurts all the other brothers there, because then there's less left over for them to divide up amongst all the Pshutim. So in our case, we have 9 Chalakim. The Bechor will get 3 for his portion as a Bechor, 2 for his portion as a Pashut, and the other 2 brothers will get 2 each for their portion of the Bechor. And as we noted already, had you done the division up front in that manner, the Bechor would only get 4.5, and the brothers would each get 2.25. So because of this deficit, that he is not counted towards the Bechorah, an extra half portion goes to the Bechor, and then they each lose 1/4 each to make up for that deficit. But again, here it's another Gzerat HaKatuv. Now we have similar concepts in other areas of halacha. This really focused on birth of a Zachar with regards to Yerusha and with regards to a Ben, the Parshiot in Ki Teitzeh. Number 1, that he doesn't count as a Bechor. Number 2 is he can't ben a Ben Sorer or Moreh. And number 3 is he's not Mema'et Chelek HaBechorah. Even if he's not the Bechor, he does not hurt the Chelek of the Bechor. Now we have other areas of halacha. Rav Shizvi Amar Afeinu Nimo. He doesn't get a Brit Milah the Shmona on the 8th day. So some read this literally on the 8th day, but the way the Rashbam reads it is that if the 8th day falls out on Shabbat, Yom Tov, or any day that would be Asur to do Malacha, it's not Doche the Shabbat, his Milah, and neither is it Doche the Yom Tov. Damar Kara, again, the Pasuk says, Isha ki tazriya veyalda zachar. When a woman conceives and then gives birth to a zachar, uba yom ha-shmini yimol, and on the 8th day, he will get a brit. Ajay zachar, mishat leida, viyalda zachar. She has to give birth to a zachar. So if at the moment of leida, he is a zachar, then he qualifies for the parshia of viyom ha-shmini imo. On the 8th day, he will get a brit milah. So now, according to those who say that he doesn't get a brit milah at all, which would be unlikely, but he doesn't have to get it on the 8th day, that's because he's mufka from the parsha. According to the Rashbam, who says that viyom ha-shmini imo basar loto, so that he is disqualified from being Doche Shabbat, that is because from that pasuk we learn out that it's on the 8th day, irrespective of which day of the week it is. Irrespective of its Yom Tov, irrespective of its Shabbat, it's Doche. So he doesn't get that qualification to be Doche Shabbat. He's still Chayav in Milah. The only problem is, how do you know that? Because this Parshia, which speaks about the Milah, the Miut that affects him for Shabbat also affects him for Milah in general. You have to notice that there is another parshia of Milah with regards to Avram Avinu. By Avram Avinu also we have a parshat Amilah. We only have the parsha to be repeated because things that are before Mamad Har Sinai would not obligate the individual. So if you get disqualified from the parshia of Shmini, then you have to find another source for that chiyuv. So that chiyuv would be by Avraham, by the parshat Amilah. But the reason we need to repeat it, because it was only by Abraham, and it's not repeated after Mamad Har Sinai, we would not necessarily be chayav. Therefore, the repetition ensures that it is unique to Jews, that this halacha applies. And then, in addition to that, we have other halachot, like being Doche Shabbat, and other rules that come out of Tazria. So what we would say is he's mufka from the Parsha Tazria, but he's not mufka from the Parsha by Abraham of the Milah. And in that way, he'll be chayav in Milah. He just won't have the advantages of Yom HaShmini and being Doche Shabbat. But here again, you have the same limud that has to be a zachar from the moment of birth. And now we have another one, which is Reb Shravia, who darshans from the same psukim there at the beginning of Parshat Tazria. Reb Shravia Amar, af eni mo tmeya leida. She's also not tmeya leida, which is the rules are that when a woman gives birth to a zachar, She is Tmeyah for 7 days, and then she has Dam Tahor for 33 days afterwards for a total of 40 days. If she gives birth to a Nekeva, then she's Tmeyah Shvu'ayim, she's Tmeyah for 2 weeks, and then she has the Dam Tahara for 66 days to give a total of 80 days. So that is the same Parshiyah that we just read before, Isha Ki Tazriya V'Yalda Zachar. That is the introduction in Parshat Tazria to the issues of Tumah as well. So there it's mentioned Milah, but it's also mentioned Tumah. From this, he comes to the conclusion that there is no din of Tumat Leida for a Tumtum. Damakra, Isha Ki Tazria, V'yalda Zachar. Utmeah Shivat Yamim. Ajay Zachar Mishat Leida. Once again, unless he's a male from the moment of birth, he's not subject to the Parsha. It's not only true by a Zachar, it would be true by a Nekeva. That little parshia of Yoledet at the beginning of Tazria says the same thing both by a Zachar and by a Nekeva. Isha ki Tazria v'yalda Zachar v'tama shivat yamim kimei nidat vota titma. And then we had the pasuk uviyom hashmini imo b'sar aloto. And then again, two psukim later, v'im Nekeva teleid v'tama shvuayim kenidata. So again, the yalda and v'teleid applies in both cases, both to Zachar and Nekeva. And what Rav Shravia is saying is that you are mufka from this parshat of Tumah. That means if you give birth to a Tumtum, you're not going to be Tmeyah whatsoever. Because you don't qualify for the Zachar category, you don't qualify for the Nekeva category. Similar to the way that you did not qualify for the Yom HaShmini, Imo Besar Oto. So all of these things are Gzerat HaKatuv, because at the moment of birth, there wasn't a determination of the gender, and therefore they're not subject to the rules of these parshiot. So the Gemara says, Meitave. We have a problem because we have a Mishnah and Nida. Mishnah and Nida says, a Mepelet Tumtum, Vadroginus, a woman who has a miscarriage, that the miscarriage was either a Tumtum or Androginus. Tumtum is what we've been dealing with until now, where it is that there is no identifiable gender in the child. Many times it's because it's submerged below the skin, and if they do surgery and open up the skin, they could find the gender. Androgynous is someone who displays both the male and female gender, meaning they have both parts of female and a male, and so uncertain as to their gender because they display both the male and the female. Then teshev lezachar nekeva. Then she has to take on the tuma or the chumrot to both a zachar and nekeva, which means that we're safek whether this is a zachar nekeva when she miscarried. Given that she miscarried, and we don't know it's a Zachar Nekeva, we treat it as if it's both a Zachar Nekeva, L'chumra. That means that you have to wait 2 weeks bituma, because that is the Nekeva, that's the Chumra of the Nekeva. But then you only get a total of 40 days like the Zachar. That means that you only have 26 days remaining of Dam Tahor. This has to do with Leida, or the Dinei Tuma of a Leida. That is when a woman gives birth, irrespective of whether she sees Dam or not. Means that it could be what they call a leida yivesha. Means a dry birth where there is no dam at all. Nevertheless, the Torah prescribes that the woman is tmeah. For zachar, 7 days, she is considered to be tmeah, whether she saw dam or not. Then she goes to the mikveh. She becomes what's called a tvul yom aroch. And for the subsequent 33 days for zachar, she is tahor, which means that any dam that she sees, she remains tahora. Now, she still has a status of Tumah, meaning that she's not allowed to enter the Mikdash, she's not allowed to eat the Korbanot. Then, on the 40th day, she goes to the Mikveh again, and then, after the sun sets on the 40th day, she now returns to her Tahara, she has to bring a Korban on the 41st day for the birth. That is, those are the Korbanot that are mentioned in Parshat Tazria. So those are the makeup of a Zachar. By Nekeva, it's just double. It's 14 days that the Dam, or if there is no Dam, she is Tmeah no matter what. After the 14th day, when she goes to the mikveh, the subsequent 66 days, she is tahora. Even if she sees dam, it's considered to be dam tahor. Over here, where you have a safek, as well as a zachar nekeva, we give her the chumrot of both. We say that she is tmeah for 14 days, no matter what. And then she only gets 26 more days where she is tahora to get up to the zachar. We don't grant her the rights till the 80th day, like a nekeva, because we're not sure if it's a zachar, not sure if it's a nekeva. So we give the chumrot to both sides. So that is a problem, because Tuyufta, the Rav Shravia Tuyufta. That is a serious refutation of the position of Rav Shravia. Rav Shravia said that when it came to a Tumtum, he's not classified as a birth at all. So therefore, there is no Tumat Zachar, no Tumat Nekeva. The Mishnah Nida is saying just the opposite. The Mishnah Nida is saying that the Tumtum is either a Zachar or an Nekeva. We just don't know which. So therefore, we give the Chumrah to both. But that means that this child or this miscarriage definitely qualifies for the parshiyah of Tumah in Tazria. The fact that it only gives you those two options shows you that it believes there is a birth here, just a question of which birth. According to Rav Shravia, there's neither. It's not a zechar, not an ekeva, and it would have been disqualified from the parsha completely. So that's why the Gemara says that this is a serious refutation of the drosha of Rav Shravia. Leimatavi tiyuv the Rav Shizvi. It should also be a refutation of the position of Rav Shizvi, because he learns out the din from the exact same parsha. The fact that he learns out that there's no mila on the eighth day that's Dochesh Shabbat is from the parsha of Tazria. So if you're telling me that in Tazria you're classified as a birth, then how can he say that you're disqualified from the Dochet the Shabbat and Yom HaShmini? So the answer is no. Tana, Svukei Misvakpile. The Tano had a Safek, Ula Chumra, and therefore he went to Chumra. So it's not that it's either Zachar or Nekeva. We don't know what the status of this baby is. Since we don't know what the status of the baby is, we have to give it the Chumrot. Give it a Chumra of Zachar, a Chumra of Nekeva. But not that we're certain that it is a birth. We might also be uncertain as to whether it's a birth at all. For Rav Shravia, he can't get out of the problem because he says it's nothing. So therefore, you can't say that the Mishnah in Nidah is going to Chumrah, because Rav Shravia says there's no birth here at all. The Mishnah is saying there is a birth, or at least there's a possibility of a birth here, and it would be qualified as a Zachar Nekeva. For Rav Shizvi, you could argue that he is saying the same thing as the Mishnah. The Mishnah says we don't know. There are three possibilities. One possibility is the Tumtum that's born is excluded from this Parsha completely. Another possibility, it's classified as a Zachar. Another possibility, it's classified as a Nekeva. So Mishnah says, go to Chumrah and treat it like a Zachar and a Nekeva. And what Rav Shizvi can say, the same thing by me. I don't know what it is. I don't know if it's a Zachar. I don't know if it's a Nekeva. I don't know if it's disqualified completely. Now, obviously for him, Nekeva is not an option, because Brit Milah then would not be relevant. So for him, it's either a Zachar or it is nothing. It's not considered to be a birth that qualifies for this Parshia. So they had to open up the baby before the eighth day. They figure out it's a Zachar. Do they give the Milah on the eighth day on Shabbat? He says, we'll have to go to Chumrah. I don't know if it's classified as a Zachar. I don't know if it's classified as a no birth. So if I don't know, I'm not going to be Dochesh Shabbat for Milah. So he could fit into that Mishnah Nidah and just say, we're both going to Chumrah. Mar says, Ihochi teshev lezachar lenekeva ulenidami boilei. If that's the case, the Mishnah should have said there are three possibilities of what the issue is. Zachar, Nekevar, Nida, Miboyele, that's what the Mishnah should have said. Kasha. That is a strong question against Rav Shizvi. You see the difference in language? Tiyufta versus Kasha. We saw earlier in the Masechta that Rashbam brings a Misora from the Gaonim, that when it says Tiyufta, that is a refutation that undermines the other person's position. On the other hand, kasha means it's a strong question, but there is a possible answer to the question. It may not be the best, it may be dochak, but there is a way to give an answer. And as Rashbam points out over here, maybe the Mishnah that says Zachar Nekeva also meant Nida. Even though it didn't write it, it was implied in it, and therefore you can't say definitively that the Mishnah is a disproof to this, but it should have said Nida would have been much clearer that way, but the absence of Nida is not necessarily definitive proof that we don't agree with Rav Shizvi. Now, what is meant by the Mishnah having to say Zachar Nekeva Unida? That is because if you want to say that there are three possibilities here, there's a possibility that the child born is a Zachar, possibility that the child born is a Nekeva, possibility that the child born is neither of those. Not because there is a Deyar, we're going to see later on in the Masechta, Rav Shimon ben Gamliel's position, which is a Tumtum, is a Birya Bifnei Atzma. It's its own creation, it's its own entity. So you can have a Zachar Nekeva, and then you can have androgynous Tumtum, which might be their own entities. And they may be neither a Zachar Nekeva, or maybe a combination of Zachar Nekeva. But that's not what we're speaking about here. We're just simply speaking about here whether you qualify for the Parshiat Tumah. So you could be classified as a Zachar, could be classified as a Nekeva, or you could classify it as nothing. You don't fit into this Parshiat at all. Even if you're found out to be a Zachar Nekeva later on, maybe you don't fit because the Gzerat HaKetuv is you need to know at the time of birth. Three possibilities. That means when the woman cites or has a sighting of Dam, there are three possibilities as to what her status is. Is she in the world of Zachar, which means for the first 7 days she's Tumeah, the subsequent 30 days, 3 days she's Torah, or is she in the world of Nekeva, 14 days of Tumah, 66 days of Tara, or is she in the world of no birth, which means she's not affected by this Parshia at all. That means that any sighting of Dam that she has makes her into a Nida. She's a regular woman who has a sighting of Dam. That's what's called Tchilat Nida, the beginning of the Nida cycle. So that's why you need that third possibility there, because that third possibility of being a nida is indicative of the fact that there's a safek, that it's neither classified as a zakhar nor a nekeva, but it's not a birth at all. And therefore, nida would be the third category you would expect to see if he was going the chumrah, like Rav Shizvi says. So that's why the Gemara says, without that word nida, it sounds like they believe it's definitely a birth, just a question of zakhar and nekeva. It doesn't give you that third possibility, which would have been no birth, which would have supported Rav Shizvi and to say that it's a nida. Now here, the Rishonim point out that why do you need zakhar in the safek at all? Wouldn't it be enough to be a safek either a nida and a nekeva? Because the zakhar is subsumed under the safek of the nekeva. The nekeva's period lasts from 14 days and then another 66, 80 days. Subsumed in that is the 40 days of the zakhar. So why does it matter about the zakhar? You're going to keep 2 weeks of tuma anyway, because it's safek that you are a nekeva. And then you're also going to keep the 66 days of tara, misafek versus nida. So why does it matter about the zakhar at all? The answer is that it might matter for a woman who has a sighting on the 34th day. A woman has a sighting on the 34th day. So now you have three sfeikot. Safek whether she's a nida, because she was not classified as giving birth to anything. Question of whether she gave birth to a zakhar, and this would be in the days of Tohar. Or a possibility that it was in a keva, and she's also in the days of Tohar. So there's no difference. But then she sees again on the 41st day. Now, when she has a sighting on the 41st day, now we have a number of possibilities of what this could be. If it was considered to be a zakhar when she gave birth, then she's now beyond the 40-day period of the zakhar. Her sighting on the 41st day is a nida, is a tchilat nida now, because she's now outside the world of leida, she's back to her normal cycling, and she's a tchilat nida. If it is a nekeva, then she's still within the world of dam tehora. And therefore, this is nothing. The sighting on the 41st day is nothing. If it was not classified as a birth at all, then what she saw on day 34 was the beginning of a nida. When she sees on the 41st day, she's already past her 7 days of nida, beginning to be in the period of what's called Yimei Ziva. A nida min Torah, as soon as she has a sighting of dam, she is tmeah 7 days, whether she sees dam, whether she doesn't see dam. She is tmeah for those 7 days. On the night after the 7th day, she goes to the mikveh. Even if she stops seeing dam immediately before that, that's fine. She doesn't have to wait any tara at all. The 7th day at night, she goes to the mikveh. That starts what's called the Yimei Ziva, 11 days of Yimei Ziva. During those 11 days, if she has a sighting 1 or 2 days, she's called Shomeret Yom Keneged Yom. She has to keep 1 day of Tara Keneged this sighting. She sees 3 days in a row, she becomes a Zava Gedola. She has to wait Shiva Nikiim and bring a Korban afterwards for the Zava Gedola. So now, if she was classified as a Ois Loida, meaning that she's a Nida on day 34, 7 days later, on the 41st day when she has a sighting, she's already into her Yimei Ziva. So now you have three Sfeikot about what the story is. If it was a Zachar, the sighting on the 41st day is Tchilat Nida. If it was a Nekeva, the sighting on the 34th and the 41st day were meaningless. If she was a nida, meaning that when she gave birth, it doesn't count as a birth at all for this parshia, that means when she saw on the 34th day, she was a nida. When she sights now on the 41st day, she's a zava, because she's already into the 11 days afterwards. She sights 1 day, or then if she sights 3 days in a row, she'll become a zava gedola. So she actually has three sfeikot. Is she a nida? Is she a zava? Or is she dam tahor? So zachar has impact on that, because the zachar cuts off at the 40th day. And therefore, there's a question about the connection between the sighting on the 34th and the 41st day. Is there a connection between them? So zakhar does have an impact, even though it's subsumed under nekeva. So that's the safek that we are dealing with here. And then you would have to wait. If you get into those situations, you have to wait. The Rishbam says 17 days of nekiim. It's really 15 days of nekiim. You have to have 15 days without a sighting of dam in order to reset the cycle to know for sure you're at the beginning of a nida cycle. But it makes it very difficult for the woman, that type of safek. But the absence of the word nida, anyway, in the end, in that Mishnah in nida, makes it difficult to suggest, like Rav Shizvi, that they were going to the chumrah, not just the chumrah of zachar nekeva, but the chumrah to say it was a birth versus a non-birth. Because a non-birth also has an aspect of chumrah that should be mentioned, which is that she would be a nida. The absence of that is not supportive of Rav Shizvi's contention. Amar Rava. Tanya Kavote de Rabbi Ami. We have a brayta that supports Rabbi Ami's contention. This is how we got into this sugya. That a tumtum is not qualified as a bechor. Ben, velo tumtum. The brayta says that a child, a male child, is considered to be a bechor, but not a tumtum. Bechor velo safek. A bechor is only someone who is definitely a bechor, but not a safek. Bishlama ben velo tumtum. I understand the first part of the bright that says it was a son and not a tumtum. Kid the Rabbi Ami. That's like Rabbi Ami, which we just said before, that if it's not a ben from Shatavaya, you don't qualify for the parshia of bechor. Ela bechor velo safek la fuke mai. What does a bechor come to tell you that it has to be a definitive bechor, not a safek? What does that come to exclude? What case are we worried about here? Obviously, if the bechor is a safek, he can't collect. Because emotzi mechaveiro alav araya. If he's a bechor mi safek, he can't come and demand his chelik ha-bechora unless he has proof or evidence of the fact. The other brothers say, sure, bring proof and you can have your bechora. If not, you're not classified as a bechor, you can't take our money. So lafuke mi dedoresh rova. It comes to exclude the drusha of rova. The Dorish Rava, Shtei Nashim Shealdu Bet Zicharim B'Michabet. Two women that gave birth to two male children in hiding. Because they're in hiding, it's difficult because it's dark and they can't discern the babies. Now, we could assume here that these are two wives of one individual and whichever child was born first is his Bechor. These are his two wives. They're about to give birth. Whichever child is born first will be the Bechor, the Nachalah. As far as the Bechor of Petarechem, that will depend on the women, whether this is their first child, not the first child they miscarried before. But as far as Bechor Lenachala, this is the first child of this man. And we don't know which of the two children was the firstborn because they were in hiding. It was dark. And when the children were born, we were uncertain as to which one was born first or the possibility that they got mixed up afterwards. We do know that one of them was the Bechor, but we just don't know which one because they got mixed up afterwards. From the Lashon of Gemara, it does not sound like that's the case, even though, in essence, the halacha would be the same. Whether it's they got mixed up, or whether we just don't know because of the circumstances that are there, it's not that they got mixed up, we just don't know which one was born first because of the circumstances. Kodvim ar sha'az elazeh. They give each other a power of attorney. They basically give each other rights to claim on the behalf. In that way, each one of them is empowered to act as a bechor. So in essence, if you have two women from two men, and they're definitely the bechor from each of these two men, I mean, these are wives of two different individuals, then they're giving a power of attorney to each other, allows them to go to the brothers and say, Mimanov Shach, I'm the bechor. Either I am the bechor here, or if I'm not the bechor, I have a power of attorney from the other bechor to say that I can collect over here. Or if it's from one individual, then they are empowering each other to go to the brothers and say, we definitely have a bechelik ha-bechor here, because either I am the bechor, or if my brother was the bechor, he gave me the power of attorney and I can collect here as the bechor. So they give Ershah Zelazeh in order to avoid the problem and empower one of the individuals to act on behalf of both of them. So Amar Leh Rav Papa, the Rava. So Rav Papa says back to Rava, V'ashalach Ravin Davar Zeh, She'alti L'chol Rabutai, V'o Lo Amri Li Davar. I asked this question, I queried of all my Rebbeim this question, and nobody gave me an answer to this. Brach kama chamru mishum Rabbi Yanai, but I did hear this over from Rabbi Yanai. Hukru ublesof nitarvu kotfrim harshah zelezeh. If there originally was a determination where they knew which one was the Bechor, and which one was not the Bechor, or in the other case where which Bechor belonged to which family, and then only after the fact they got mixed up, then they're allowed to write a power of attorney to each other. Lo kru, if they were never discerned as being the Bechor, the mix-up was from the outset. They were unable to determine which was born first, or they didn't know to which family the Bechor was born. They were mixed up from the moment they were born. Ein kotvim harshah zelezeh. They don't write a harshah zelezeh. They cannot institute this power of attorney. Hadar uki rova amora ale. Rova then put up a new amora. Amora is someone who speaks on behalf of the amora, rova. He's the equivalent of his loudspeaker, his translator. Rava whispers to him and then he speaks to the people. So he reconvened the shir in order to say, "Bedarash, Devarim Shemarti Lachem Ta'ut Ein Biyadi." I made a mistake before when I gave you the drasha about the Bechor getting mixed up. I said, irrespective of how they got mixed up, they can write a power of attorney to each other. But that was wrong. Barach, Kav Chamru Mishum Rabbi Yanai. This is what Rabbi Yanai says, and this is the way that it should be. If at one point it was discerned, delineated which one was the Bechor, which one wasn't, or in the case of two families, which Bechor belonged to which family, if we knew which at first, then they got mixed up, they can empower each other with a power of attorney. Lo hukru. If there was never any discernment as to which one was the Bechor, or to which family the Bechor belonged to, ain kodvim arsha zeh lezeh. They cannot empower each other with the power of attorney to act as one party to collect on behalf of the Bechor. So, Rova, from a logical standpoint, said that it should work. In any case of safek, it should work that if you give a power of attorney, you should be able to empower the Bechor to come and collect. What Rabbi Yanai basically says is the same drasha that we had before, that you can aben velo tumtum. You need to know whether he was a zachar from the time of birth in order to be classified as a bechor, and therefore a tumtum is excluded, even though we find out that he's a zachar later on, and is entitled to split in the Yerusha. He's classified as a male child to split in the Yerusha. He's just disqualified as a bechor. That same disqualification will have application over here as well, which is you need to know who the bechor is at the moment of birth. You have to be able to identify the bechor. If there's a mix-up later on, that's fine. Then you can use the power of attorney to overcome that problem. But if at the moment of birth, there was no discernment as to who the Bechor is, then it fails the test of the Pasuk, which is at the moment of Havayah, you did not know who the Bechor was, and therefore the Pasuk undermines, in a sense, Rava's logic. Rava, it makes sense if you didn't have a Gzeret HaKatuv. But the Gzeret HaKatuv says you must know who the Bechor is at the moment of birth. Without information, you cannot create these powers of attorney between the two parties. Right? The Tosafot over here raises an interesting issue, which is Rav Papa. Rav Papa, on yesterday's daf, said, Rav Papa in the name of Rava says, that a Bechor has no rights to his distribution until it's distributed. That means that he doesn't have any rights to sell, transact, to disown himself from the Chelika Bechorah prior to the time that he got the Chalukah, to the time that he got the division. The rights don't pre-exist. Over here, he's writing a harsha'ah, a power of attorney, to the other party, even though he has yet to come into those rights. How does he give over something to another party if he doesn't have any rights to it? That's davar shelo bali olam. That's something that is not in the world yet. It's an intangible object. And you're trying to transfer a right that you don't have to another party. How does that work? Because Rav Papa over here is saying that a harsha'ah works, the power of attorney works, yet before he said the Bechor has no rights until he gets his distribution. So how is he writing harsha'ah before the distribution is given? Now, if he can't get the harsha'ah in place beforehand, they're never going to distribute it to him as the Bechor. So how do you reconcile between these two statements of Rav Papa? So the Rishonim have different approaches to this. One of them is to say that Rav Papa changed his mind. The Rav Papa, yes, back there thought that the din was that a Bechor has no rights beforehand. This seems to indicate that he changed his mind and thinks that a Bechor does have rights beforehand. The Baal Yad Tosafot, on the other hand, answer in the following manner. Omeri, denze bala mi koach shlichut. Power of attorney does not work by you being makneh, you granting rights to the other party, taking your rights that you own and giving it to the other party. The power of attorney works by appointing the other individual to be your emissary, to be your shliach. So when he comes to act, he's either acting on behalf of himself, or he's acting as a shliach for you to collect the rights. So that means that he's not independently, he doesn't own the rights. You didn't give him rights and ownership over the rights. You simply made him into your emissary, into your shliach. And in doing so, he can act either on behalf of himself or on behalf of you. Either way, he will succeed then at getting the Bechor, because he's both simultaneously representing himself as well as representing the other party. But it's not coming from a kinyan over the right. Or the other possible conclusion you come to this is that we made a mistaken assumption here. We assumed that a harsha'ah could only be written about something where you had the ability to be makneh the rights. Maybe that's not true. Maybe you can write a harsha'ah even about things that you don't have the physical ability to makneh the rights. Harsha'ah is powerful enough to overcome that problem of davar shelo bali olam, which is the view of the Ramban and others. So those are three different approaches to reconcile Rav Papa's statement here with Rav Papa from yesterday. Right now, Shalchulei bnei Akra d'Agma l'Shmuel. So the people of Akra d'Agma, it seems to be it's the name of a location. It could be a proper noun, Akra d'Agma, or it could be a description of a place, meaning that the location was Akra next to the swamp, or it's a place where they have the reeds by the swamp. It was a place that was known by its description. So whether it's a proper noun or whether it's a description of a place that was well known, they send a question to Shmuel. Yilamdeinu Rabbeinu, please teach us, our Rebbe. Hayu muchzakim bezeh shu bechor. They knew that this individual was a bechor. V'amar aviv al acher bechor hu. The father, on the other hand, comes along and says, he's not the firstborn. Another one of my children is the firstborn. Mahu, what is the din in that case? Is the father empowered to overcome what was common knowledge until this time? We know that the father is empowered, because we're about to have him on the second half of today's daf, that quotes the psukim from Parshat Ki Tetzeh, which says that the father has a right to be yakir, to recognize, acknowledge, or define who is the bechor. Kid bechor ben asnua, yakir latei lo pishnayim. He will identify the bechor, even though he's the eldest child of the one that was disliked. He will identify him in order to give him the double portion. So that's yakir, means that the father is the one who can make that hakara, can make that identification. So the father has a certain amount of superpower here in order to identify who the bechor is. The problem is we have an offsetting factor. The way that the Rashbam reads it is that they were muchzakim shu bechor, not that they're edim. We don't have witnesses to the fact that he was a bechor. We simply have rumors, or the father until this point had called him a bechor. Until this point in time, there was some sort of indication of this child being the bechor. Either the father treated him like a bechor, called him a bechor until this point in time, or we have rumors, the word around town is that he is the bechor. Then all of a sudden the father comes and says, no, he's not the bechor. Another one of the children is the bechor. Does he have a power to overcome what was a chazakah until now, that the other child was the bechor? That's the way the Rashbam reads it. On the other hand, the Ramban and others believe that it's even in the face of Edim. This could even be in the face of Edim testifying that the child was a bechor, and the father comes along and says that he's not the bechor. The other child is the bechor. Does he have the power to overcome the Edim? That relates to a machloket about Rabbi Yehuda's position in the upcoming Mishnah, when Rabbi Yehuda says the father's empowered. How empowered is he? Is he empowered even to the point where he can overcome Edim? That's the view of the Ramban. Whereas the view of the Rashbam here is he's only empowered to overcome chazokah, rumors. But Edim, he doesn't have the ability to overcome. So that would be the nature of the question being posed to Shmuel. Shalach lo, he said to them, kotvim harsha'a ze lezeh. They should write powers of attorney to each other. It will solve the problem. It will solve the problem by the one who was had the chazakah as a bechor, and the one now fingered by the father to be the bechor. If they write powers of attorney to each other, together they will be able to collect the chelek ha-bechora. So Gemara says, what type of answer is that? Monof shach. What is Shmuel saying? He needs to figure out what sock is he giving them. Ikra bonan svirle. If he holds like the Rabbonon that the father is not empowered to identify the Bechor, lishlech l'chukir Rabbonon. Let him say to them, the Locha is like the Rabbonon. Ikar Rabbi Yehuda Svirle, if he paskins like Rabbi Yehuda, which is that the father is empowered to identify the Bechor, lishlech l'chukir Rabbi Yehuda. Let him say to them, the Pesach Locha is like Rabbi Yehuda. What must be the answer? Misapkile, Ikar Rabbi Yehuda, Ikar Rabbonon. He was in doubt. He didn't know if the Loch is like Rabbi Yehuda or the Chachamim, whether the Loch is like Rabbi Yehuda or the Rabbonon. And therefore, he gave them a suggestion, which is, let them write a harsha to each other, because I'm not sure if the Loch is like Rabbi Yehuda, and therefore the one fingered by the father is the Bechor, or the Loch is like the Chachamim, and that means that the original one who had the Chazokah is the one who is the Bechor. So if they write a harsha to each other, then we're certain that between the two of them, one of them is the Bechor, and they can collect. So Mahi, what is this machloket that you were speaking about between Rabbi Yehuda and the Chachamim? D'tanya, we have a braita. Yakir, the pasuk as we read before says, Yakir latet lo pishnayim. Yakir, yakirenu l'acherim. He can identify for others which one of the children is the Bechor. Mikan amar Rabbi Yehuda, neman adam lomar zebni Bechor. This individual is empowered or believe to identify for us which one of his children is the Bechor. Ukushem Shineman Adam Lomar Shdebni Bechor. Just like a person is empowered to say that this child is the Bechor. Kach Neman Adam Lomar Zeb Ben Grushav Zeb Ben Chalutza. He can also identify his child and say, this child that was born is a Ben Grushav Ben Chalutzav. He's a Kohen. And he married a divorcee. Or he's a Kohen and married someone who was a Chalutza. That's only a din d'rabbanan. But in either case, if he marries these women that are inappropriate, the child born of that marriage is considered to be a halal, and he's disqualified from being a Kohen. So he can identify his child as being a halal. So Rabbi Yehuda says, not only is the power to identify the child as being a bechor, he can also identify a child as being a ben grusha ben chalutza, and disqualify him from being a Kohen. Chachamim say he's not believed. They don't darshan the word yakir over here to mean that he has the rights of identification in the face of opposition. The Chachamim are going to explain that the yakir in the pasuk is a case where we don't have any information. Then the father is empowered to identify it. But if we have conflicting information, which is there's a chazak or a edim up against him, then the father is not empowered enough to identify the child. That's the view of the Rabbanim. The Rabbi Yehuda's view is that the father's empowered, even in the face of a chazakah. Even in the face of opposing information, he's empowered. For the Rishban, that means even against the chazakah. For the Ramban, that means even up against a deem identifying the Bechor. Tosafot asks the question that you're basically asking, which is, how do you see from this pasuk that he's allowed to identify his child as a ben chalutza or ben grusha? It's one thing to identify the child as a Bechor. That is a privilege. That is something where he's giving him his zchut. So you can do something that is to the benefit of another party, you can be believed. Who says over here he's empowered to disqualify parties? How do you know that he's empowered here to say that this is a halal? He's ruining this person's yichus. I mean, it's his own child, but he's ruining his yichus and he can no longer be a kohen. Where do you see in the pasuk that he's allowed to do that? So the Baal Yetos Vod asked this question, Tema, just because he's neman by Bechor, he should be neman lifsol, v'yesh lomar. Since the Pasuk believed him to pick the Bechor, believed him in general, which is that in a situation in which he has five children, let's say, until now, we thought number one child was the Bechor. All of a sudden he comes along and says, no, number three is the Bechor. What does that imply about the first two children? That means that he is now saying about the first two children that they are mamzerim. They're not his children. If they was his children, then child number one and two would have been the Bechor. One would have been the Bechor. The fact that he's now saying number three is the Bechor says that one and two are not his children. Wait a minute. This woman gave birth to these children. She's only been married to him. That means that the first two children are Mamzerim. And he's declaring they're Mamzerim. So out of his statement of making the other child the Bechor, a derivative of that is the disqualification of other children. So that's how the Baal Yetos Vod we see from the case of Bechor, that the father is not only empowered to identify the Bechor, but through his identification of the Bechor, he's also being posel, the other children. And in doing so, he's now also empowered to be posel. Now, that could be limiting, which is that maybe he's only allowed to do that in a indirect manner. You might be able to be posel children by identifying or saying something that is a positive statement, and the derivative of that positive statement is the negative ramifications for the other children. Who says you can directly identify somebody as being a pasul? So then you have another reasoning brought by the Rabbeinu Eliyahu here in the Baal Yetos Sefot, Mefaresh Yakir Nami Koya Ben Asnua. Because it says in the pasuk, Ket Bechor Ben Asnua Yakir Lo Latet Lo Pishnayim. So it's speaking about the Bechor came from the woman who was Snia. Why is she Snua? Chazal darshan over here, snia means snia ben nisueha. Snia ben nisueha means she's hated in her marriage. Her marriage is improper halachically. There's something wrong with the marriage halachically. And despite that fact, he can be yakir. He can identify the child of the ben asnua. So what you see from here is that he's empowered to identify the child as being a child of a snua. Even here in this case, it happens to be that he's the bechor. But it also could identify him as being a product of a marriage that was improper, because it's a bena snua. So Rabbeinu Eliyahu says where the word yakir appears in the parshia is identified with the bena snua. The bena snua is a product of a hated marriage. A hated marriage doesn't mean like we would read the pasuk in Pashtut, which means he disliked his wife. It's disliked because HaKadosh Baruch Hu disliked the marriage. It was an improper marriage, and that's why it's a bena snua. So Rabbeinu Eliyahu brings it as a proof. The Tosafot over here says that our Gemara in the Bavli does not seem to support his contention, though the Yerushalmi does support his contention. Therefore, he says that maybe the Yerushalmi thinks in that manner. That's the way that we know that he can be posel. Then the Tosafot and the discussion that we just had before says that we pass on like Rabbi Yehuda. And this machloka between Rabbi Yehuda and the Chachamim, we pass on like Rabbi Yehuda that he does have a right of identification. And then he writes, Uposek Bahag, the Baal Halachot Gedolot is Posek, Dad the Paskin and the Kaman Halachot Rabbi Yehuda. The fact that we pass on like Rabbi Yehuda is Dafka Sheposel Yedei Hakarat Bechorah. It's only when it's an indirect disqualification of the child. If he identifies the Bechor, then indirect disqualification is it. He's not empowered to finger the child and say that he is a pasul, and that's it. He doesn't have that power. That's what the Bahag says, and the Tosafot concludes, the Ri disagrees, and thinks that when we say the Halacha is like Rabbi Yehuda, the Halacha is like Rabbi Yehuda, through and through. He's Ne'eman to identify the Bechor. He's also Ne'eman to identify someone who is Pasul. It might have to do with the source for why you think he's believed. If the source is the fact that he can say that he's a Bechor, that also identifies the others as being disqualified, then if you prove it from there, then maybe the Bahag is right, which is that the only time that you're believed is when it happens as an indirect consequence of your identifying the Bechor. If you use the Rabbeinu Eliyahu, who says the Pasuk is talking about a Ben Asnua, and it says Yakir, he can identify him as a Ben Asnua, that means that inherently you have a right to identify the child as a Pasul. And therefore, it would apply even when you are fingering the child as a psul, nothing to do with the bechorah. So the source of why you think he's believed might impact on how broad you think the din is, like Rabbi Yehuda. Right now, the Gemara says, "Amar le Rav Nachman by Yitzchak the Rava, Bishlam ol Rabbi Yehuda, according to Rabbi Yehuda, Hainu dichtiv Yakir." I understand why the pasuk says Yakir, because the father is empowered to identify. El Rabbanon Yakir lamali. What do you need the Yakir for? And this is what we noted before, Bitzarich Hakeira, where we need to identify the child. We have no idea which child is the Bechor. You have a family moved into town, and nobody knows the children, nobody knows who was born first. The father has a right to say, this is the oldest child, this is the Bechor. L'may Hilchoto, what is the Halacha that derives from this? L'met Valo Pishnayim, of course, to give him double portion. Mar says, why do you need a halacha? Why do you need a pasuk to teach you that the father has a right to identify the Bechor and give him a double portion? Lo yehei ala acher. Let him be a third party. Can't he give a gift to a third party? If he's distributing his assets and he wants to give a double portion to someone, he can give a double portion to whoever he wants. He gave a double portion to a Bechor. He gave a double portion to one of his other children. He gave a double portion to a neighbor. He can give it to whoever he wants. So why is it important that he identifies for us the Bechor over here? Because he can make that determination, or he can make that distribution, irrespective of who the Bechor is. He can just distribute his assets and give a double portion to that person. So why do we care that he can identify for us who the Bechor is over here? Lo, tzricha b'nechasim shnaflulo l'achar mikan. The problem is nechasim that come after the identification, or the moment of identification. So say, for instance, one day he comes to the court and he says, I want you to know that this child is the Bechor. Court says, okay, we don't really care that he's the Bechor. You can give away your assets. You can divest of your properties any way you want. But that is only true for items that exist today. At that date, when he makes that identification, he could have distributed his property to whoever he wants. So you're right, he could have given him the double portion, so why do we care he's the Bechor? From that day forward, it does have impact. Because that day forward, he can't give property in the future. It's not in his possession yet. He doesn't have access to it. It's not his. It's davar shelo bali olam. So he can't give that away. The fact that he fingered this child as being the Bechor will have impact that that child will get the double portion and all property after that point in time. Because he is not empowered to give things in the future, but his identification of the child as a Bechor will have impact for the future, not just for the present. Matana can only affect that which is present today. You can distribute that. But you can't distribute things that don't exist yet. You can't distribute things in the future. So that's why his ability to identify the Bechor has impact. According to Rabbi Meir, who in the Gemara and Kiddushin argues on the Chachamim and says that even something that is yet to come into the world, you can trade in it. You can have kinyanim in davar shelo bali olam. Then you could gift all your property or a double portion of whatever you have, both of what you have now, and that which you will acquire in the future, you could have gifted away as a double portion. So then why do we need to know who the Bechor is? You could just do this whole thing as a gift, and you could avoid the problem. We don't even care who the Bechor is, because you can circumvent the whole problem. Now, why is it especially important here that Rabbi Meir's position be resolved? So number one, the Gemara in general likes to resolve all Tanaim and to have them fit into all the different sugyot. But over here, as the Rashbam points out, it's especially important because generally the Baal Plukta of Rabbi Yehuda is Rabbi Meir. Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Meir are usually the ones who argue. So in the Braita before about Yakir, we said Rabbi Yehuda believes the father is believed. The Chachamim say he's not. Well, the Chachamim, in all likelihood, is the position of Rabbi Meir. And so if that's the position of Rabbi Meir, the Chachamim, how do you reconcile Rabbi Meir's position now? Rabbi Meir is saying that Chachamim say you can't identify a Bechor when there's no contrary evidence. But then why is there any nafkamina? Why is there any value to that? Rabbi Meir acknowledges you have the ability to do kinyanim even into the future, even on intangible objects that don't exist yet. You can trade in them, you can give kinyanim. So why do you need this ability to identify the Bechor? My answer is, v'nechasim shenaflo shu goses. Property that fell to him when he was on the precipice of death. Goses is someone who is definitely going to die. They're hovering between life and death, and they're at that moment they're going to pass away. Now, it's not because the goses doesn't have the ability to acquire and pass on property inherently. He does have the ability to do it, and if he did do it, it would work. The problem here is that a goses, in all likelihood, can't speak anymore and can't motion. So he can't indicate or he can't redistribute the property or give out a matana. So again, if he has property that comes into his possession and he says, well, I was makne everything in the future to the Bechor, or who I identified as the Bechor. So again, at a given date, he comes along and he says, this is the Bechor. So why do we care? Because what he can do is gift all of his property to this individual, both property he owns today, as well as property that he has in the future. The problem is that he will reach a certain point in the future where the property that comes at that point in time, he's no longer able to control or able to pass on to someone else. So even though Rabbi Meir acknowledges that you have a right to pass on future property, that's only in the case where that future property is likely to come into your possession or has meaning in your possession. Once you're a goses, we don't assume that the person is really getting the property or it's still within the rubric of future properties that you will accept. And so for that reason, you need the Yakir to identify the Bechor to get the double portion, because he can't grant that present in the future all the time that he's a goses. Because he says over here, the Rishbam points out, Dafil Rabbi Meir, the Shadam Makne Davar Shalom Bali Olam, Hani Mile Ko Nechasim Shnoflim Lov Shash Yesh Bo Koach Nidneim Lacherim. That's only property that comes into his possession where he had the ability to give them to others at that moment. But a goses, which has no ability to gift the property at that time, not halachically, he's considered to be alive, and he could do it, but he's physically impaired to the point where he can't grant the property. He can't then gift them for the future, if the point in the future, he won't be able to gift them. Because at the point that it comes into his hand, he still needs to be able to control them. Your ability to set things in motion in the future is only for things that you will control in the future. If you will never control those items in the future, then you can't do it. Because you can only be makneh davar shelo bali olam in something that you could be makneh, that you could grant ownership to someone else in the future, that you are impaired to do when you are a goses, and therefore it won't work for davar shelo bali olam. The Bali HaTosafot add another possibility is in a case where these are assets that are not expected, because many of the Amoraim qualify Rabbi Meir's position and say that only in things that avidi da'atu, things that normally come about, or things that you would expect. But if it's an item d'lo avidi d'atu, then that's not included in davar shelo bali olam, or something that you can generate a kinyan for, because it's not something that you would have expected at the time that you entered into the kinyan. So again, the goses doesn't have the ability to gift in the future, so when property comes into his possession, it's not governed by the original gift that he gave. So for Rabbi Meir, that period of time, Yakir makes a difference. Identify him as the Bechor will tie him to a double portion there, because you can't gift that to him as a double portion. And so therefore you need the Chelek HaBechorah to be identified by the Bechor, and not through a simple gifting of a double portion of your assets. All right. Tan Rabbanan. Hayu Muchzakim Bo Shu Bechor. Again, the child was known as a Bechor. For the Rishbam, that means that there were rumors, there was information circulating that he was a Bechor. According to Ramban, it means more strongly than that. It was Edim. V'amar Aviv Alacher Shu Bechor. Father comes along and identifies another one of the children as a Bechor. Naaman, he is believed. Hayu muchzakim bo she'enu Bechor. If the chazaka was that he wasn't a Bechor, V'amar Be'aviv Bechoru. And then the father comes and identifies him as the Bechor, enu Naaman. He is not believed. So this is strange. In one case, he is believed to change the child from not being a Bechor into being a Bechor. Because there was someone else identified as the Bechor, he can overcome that issue. But if he comes and says someone who was identified not as a Bechor, and there's a chazaka that he wasn't a Bechor, the father's not empowered to then make him into the Bechor. Why should there be any difference? If he's believed, he should be believed in either case. Gemara's answer is, Reisha Rabbi Yehuda v'Sefer HaBoma. This bright is altered or follows two different positions. In the ratio, the first statement is following Rabbi Yehuda's position, where the father is empowered to overcome a chazakah or to overcome a deem. And the seifa, it's the Rabbanan's position, where he's not empowered to do so. And so the answer of the Gemara is, Reisha Rabbi Yehuda, Seifa Rabbanan, you're right. It's an inconsistency in the Braita, because the authorship or the positions which this Braita follows are also dissimilar in nature, and that's why you come out to a different conclusion. I'm Rabbi Yochanan. Amar Benihu. Father says about some individual, he is my son. V'chazar v'amar, and then later on he changes his mind and says, Abdihu, he's my slave. Eino ne'aman, he's not believed. He can't change the identification of a child to a slave if he's already identified this individual as a child. The Rishbam goes as far as to say that is even toch kedei dibur. That means that even within toch kedei dibur, which generally we say is still considered as if you're talking, the Rishbam says you still cannot change your mind. Most other Rishonim believe that toch kedei dibur, you can change your mind because it's considered to be one speaking, and therefore it's not binding. The first thing you said is not binding. Whatever you conclude with or whatever you say at the end is binding. But once you've already stopped speaking and now you go on to a new conversation and all of a sudden you say, you know what? He's not my son. He's my slave. He's not believed in that case. Vice versa, Avdiu, if he first identified him as my Eved, and then V'chazar V'amar B'niu, and then he says he's my child, Ne'aman. There he is believed. Why is that? The Mishamesh Li Ke'Avda Ke'amar. Because in that case, we can explain his rescinding of his original statement that he was an Eved. Because in that case, we can say that the reason he called him an Eved is not because he's a slave, but my child is such a good child that he does things for me that not only a child would do, but even something that an Eved would do. He services me in that manner. So then later on, when he identifies himself as a child, that's not an undermining of the statement that he said before. The principle at work here is what the Rishbam points out, the din of edut, which is kaven shi'igit. Once a person makes a declaration, shuvenu chuzer magid. You don't have a right to rescind, to take back that which you said and reformulate it. So we learned this together, these halachot together in the Gemara in Bava Metzia, and then we learned there that it depends. Kaven shi'igit, shuvenu chuzer magid. It depends on what you're doing with the second statement. If the second statement is contradictory to the first statement, then you don't have a right to rescind your original edut, and you're bound by your original statement. Whatever your original statement is, you're bound, you can't change your mind later. On the other hand, if your second statement can then be reinterpreted to fit with the first statement, then we don't consider it to be shuv chuzer magi. We don't consider it to be a new testimony, but rather a clarification of the previous testimony. So in the latter case, where he first identifies him as an eved, and then he identifies him as a ben, what we're going to say is he didn't change his mind. He didn't say he was an Eved first, then a ben. But rather, we're going to reinterpret his first statement in light of his second statement. The second statement that says he's a son, now we understand what he meant when he said Eved first. When he meant Eved, he didn't mean that he was really an Eved. It just means that he services me like an Eved. And in that case, it's not considered to be a rescinding of the first statement, just a qualification of the first statement. And the other way around, it doesn't work. If he first identifies him as a son, and then identifies him as an Eved, you can't say that. You can't say, oh, you know what? He's so beloved to me that I call him a son. So even though he really is an Eved, I call him a son. The Rishbam says that is outside the bounds. People will never call an Eved a son, no matter how close they are to them, how much they're part of the family. It's considered to be taboo to call a Eved a child. And therefore, it's considered to be as if you are changing your testimony, and that you can't do. So if you identified him as a Ben up front, you now can't come back and identify him as an Eved. So that's the explanation for the statements over here. The Rishbam points out that a child does certain things for a father. For instance, he puts on his shoes, he dresses him, he helps him bathe, he takes care of his father. Eved, or an Eved Kenani, does things that are even bizuyim. Again, especially in a hierarchical society where certain parts of society did not engage in certain activities, then an Eved does engage in those activities. A normal child would not engage in those activities. So when the father says that my child is like an Eved, that means that what he's saying is that he's even doing those things that are bzuyim. Even though normally a child would not do these things, he's still doing them, and that's why he called them an Eved up front, because he does those activities that normally a person would not do. They would relegate that to an Eved. My son is such a good son that he services me in that manner. And for that reason, I called him an Eved, not because he is an Eved, but because he does the same things that an Eved would do. Now the conclusion statement of Rabbi Yochanan is v'chilufei abeit ha-meches. The exact opposite is true when it comes to the tax authorities. Right, so without getting into the validity of what is being done here, we've discussed this in other contexts about cheating on taxes, avoiding taxes, when taxes are fair or not fair, all those things we have dealt with. Let's just assume that whatever is being done here is correct. So now you come by the tax authorities. If you identify a person that is with you as an Eved, you have to pay taxes on the Eved. That's whatever the rules were at that time when you passed the tax toll booth. If you are traveling with an Eved, you have to pay a tax on the Eved. If you're traveling with your child, you're not obligated to pay taxes. So now, if you pass the tax toll booth and you identify the person with you as your child, and then after you leave the area, you say, no, he's not my child, he's an Eved, over there you're believed. The only reason you identified him as your child when you passed the toll booth is to get out of the taxes. So it's obvious that you did it to avoid the taxes, and later on when you say it's an Eved, that's not implausible. On the other hand, if when you were passing the tax authorities, you called him an Eved, and then once you passed the tax authorities, you call him a Ben, that would be counterintuitive. Why would you identify him as an Eved and have to pay the taxes, and then after the fact, identify him as a Ben, where you wouldn't have to pay the taxes? You would have identified him as a Ben originally. So in that case, you cannot reverse your statement. So that's what it means, chilufei beit ha-meches, just the opposite by the tax authorities, which is, by the tax authorities, it's your benefit to call him a Ben. So if you call him an Eved, you're bound by it, because that was the worst of your two choices. If you picked it, it must be true. So then you're bound by him being an Eved, and you can't change it to a Ben. The other way around, you can change it, because identifying him as a Ben is monetarily beneficial to you, because then you don't have to pay the taxes. Then later on when you say he's an Eved, okay, it makes sense. You were trying to escape the tax authority. It explains it. If he's passing the tax authorities and says he's my son, in that case he's believed. Amar Avdiu, on the other hand, when he's passing the tax authorities, he identifies him as a slave. And then afterwards he says, he's my son. Einu Ne'eman. So now we have Meitavei. We have a problem. Haya Mishamsho Keben. If the individual was servicing him like a child would service him. Ubava Amar Beniu. And he says, this is my son. V'chazav Amar Avdiu. Then later on he says, you know what, he's not my son, he's my Eved. Einu Ne'eman. He's not believed. This is similar to what Rabbi Yochanan said, that you can't change someone from being a child into an Eved. That's improper. Haya Mishamsho Ke'eved. If he's servicing him like an Eved. Uba V'amar Avdihu, and he identifies him as an Eved. V'chazav Amar, later on he says, no, he's not an Eved, B'nihu, Einu Ne'eman. He's not believed. That goes against what Rabbi Yochanan said. Rabbi Yochanan says you can change from being an Eved into a Ben, and the reason was because, the reason I called him an Eved is because he's servicing me like an Eved. Over there, we don't even know that. Over here, you know for sure he was servicing him like an Eved. There should be more evidence to the fact that the only reason he called him an Eved is because of the way he was servicing him. So why shouldn't he be Ne'eman over here? So it says Stira, or it's a question on Rabbi Yochanan. We have a Tanaic work that seems to go against the position of Rabbi Yochanan. Avraham Nachman bar Yitzchak, Hatam dekarolei Avda Mitzar Meya. Over there, in the case of the Braita, he's calling him the Avda Mitzar Meya. My Mitzar Meya. What does it mean, Mitzar Meya? Mitzar Avda Kuvzuze. This Eved is worth 100 zuz. In essence, what he's saying is, this is my 100 dinar Eved. This is my 100 zuz Eved. He identifies the Eved with a price. He says, this Eved costs me this much, or this Eved is worth this much, or this Eved is worth the equivalent of a field of 100 zuz. What he's saying over there, he's doing or saying something that is could only be said about an Eved, because an Eved is identified by price. People are not identified by price. Property is identified by price. And unless this really was an Eved, he would not put a price tag on it. If he's calling his son an Eved, that's one thing to say that he services me as an Eved. To call his son an Eved worth 100 zuz, that's already something that's demeaning to someone who's not an Eved. You're treating them like property or speaking to them about property like property. You don't do that if they're not property. So here, the statement is so obvious that it has to be an Eved because of the language that he uses. That's why he's not allowed to reverse it later on. He can't reinterpret that statement and say, ah, it's not really an Eved. He was servicing me like an Eved. You don't use pricing, or you don't use a statement that involves pricing to identify someone who's servicing you as an Eved. Rabbi Abba, Rabbi Yosef Bar Chama. So now, Rabbi Abba sent the Rabbi Yosef Bar Chama. This, what we're about to say now, has nothing to do with our sugya. The only reason it's brought here is because we're going to have more of them. Shalaklai Rabbi Abba, Rabbi Yosef Bar Chama, and one of them is going to end up saying that the halacha is like Rabbi Yehuda. So we're bringing these all down because we're eventually going to get to one of these statements that says the halacha is like Rabbi Yehuda. But in the interim, we're going to have a whole bunch of other questions that were asked by Rabbi Abba of Rabbi Yosef Bar Chama. Omer lechaveiro, avdi ganavto. He says to his friend, you stole my slave. V'omer lo ganavti, I didn't steal it. So then he says, ma'tivu etz lechas, and then why do you have him? Ata machartoli, you sold him to me. Ata natatoli b'matana, you gifted it to me. So we have his word against his word. He's saying, listen, that's my evet. And the other party is saying, no, it's not your evet. So he says, well, then how did you get this evet? He says, you sold it to me. You gave it to me as a gift. So he's not denying the first person's ownership. He's just saying that you have relieved yourself of that ownership by transferring the ownership to me either through a gift or through a sale. So in that case, the party that has him doesn't have to do anything. The claimant doesn't have any evidence to the fact that he owned this slave. And he doesn't have any way to prove that the slave is his. So the party that's in possession of him, in essence, has a chazakah. Since he has a chazakah, he is deemed to be the rightful owner over here, and he wouldn't have to do anything. He doesn't have to respond to this party in any judicial manner. Now, how he establishes a chazakah over here is somewhat difficult, because we said early on in the Masechta, Godrot, items that are animate do not have a chazakah associated with them. The reason is because possession is not necessarily a proof of ownership, because they can walk on their own. Property doesn't move. So if it's in your possession, that's a good indication of the fact that you own it. Metaltalin that are inanimate, if they're in your possession, that possession is indication of ownership. But the fact that animals that move around or avadim that move around end up in your possession, that's not necessarily a proof of ownership because they could have walked over there of their own volition. So either you have to say is, and we saw this earlier in the Masechta, here the response says you had them for 3 years. So not only are they in your possession, but you also have them in your possession for 3 years, so that it gives you an additional koach to your possession or your chazakah. Or we're talking about a child or an eved that can't walk on his own. There we said it's a katan barisato. It's a katan that doesn't move on his own. He's in his crib. So the only way he could have gotten over here is if it was moved or was transferred. There the Gemara asks, what about his mother? Maybe his mother moved him over there. So he came up with ways to say that there could be a change through chazakah, even though generally animate objects do not have a chazakah. So now, even though he has no obligations to respond to the claimant over here, he does anyway. This is a problem in life where people talk too much. When they talk too much, they get themselves into a problem. So this is what he did here. Ritzoncha, he says, listen, if you want shva betul, go ahead and take a shvua and you can take it. Vinishba. And he does that. Eni achol achzor bo. You can't back out of it. So over here, as the Rashbam points out over here, number one, this person had no obligation for a shvua. First of all, we're talking about avadim. Avadim are excluded from the parsha of shvua. Number two is, he has a chazakah. And it's a motzi mechavero alav araya. Min haTorah, there's only a nishba ve poter atzmo. If the shvua, if there was any shvua, it would be on him in order to release himself. He doesn't, the other party doesn't have a right to take a shvua and collect. So here he empowered him in two ways. He empowered him to say, if you take a shvua, you can keep it. But number two is nishba benotel. Not only am I allowing you to give a shvua, I'm allowing you to take a shvua that will allow you to keep the item or take it out of my possession. So he empowered him in two ways. First of all, to take a shvua. Number one, to take a shvua, that's not the shvua d'oraita. Which shvua d'oraita is you take a shvua and you're patur. He's going to take a shvua and collect it. So he's granting the claimant a right to take a shvua and collect it. Eino yachol achzorbo has no right of retraction. Since he accepted it, it is binding on him. My kamash malan. Why is that teaching us anything? Tanina. We already have a Mishnah in Sanhedrin that tells you this. Amar lo neman alai abba, neman alai avicha. If a person says, someone who was otherwise disqualified from being a judge in a case, he says, you know what, despite the fact that my father is disqualified from being a judge, or your father is disqualified from being a judge, I accept them as being judges in this case. Neman alai shlosha ru'e bakar. I am willing to accept these three cowboys as being judges in the case. Rishba makes a little note over here that they're ru'e bakar, not ru'e tzon, because ru'e tzon are normally rishaim because they steal from other people and they'd be disqualified from being judges in that way. Disqualification here of the ru'e bakar is not that they're inherently pasul, it's just that they're not knowledgeable. They don't have the information to pass in the din. But he accepts them as being the judges. In the previous case, the father or the father of the other party, they're disqualified because of their kirva, because of their relationship. They might be knowledgeable. They might be able to get to the right psak din, but they're disqualified because of their kirva. What we see from that Mishnah is that if he accepts these individuals as being the judges in the case, then it is binding. Rabbi Meir Omer, Yachol Achzorba. Rabbi Meir says you can walk away from this. Chamim Armim, Eino Yachol Achzorba. Chachamim say you can't walk away from it. It's the equivalent of binding arbitration. You basically now identify these individuals as being the judges, and you accept whatever their psak is, because you basically entered into an arbitration where you said it will be binding on you, even though it doesn't take on the power of a court decision, because they are not a proper court. But your allowing them to do so grants them that power. In the Gemara in Sanhedrin, there's a machloket there as to what the position of the Chachamim and Rabbi Meir revolves around. Is their position or their argument only in a case where he says you're patur? In a case where he says you're patur, that's where they have their machloket. But everybody agrees if these Roi Bakar or the fathers say you must pay, that that's not binding. Because there's no kinyan over here. There's a lack of kinyan. Michila, you can grant. So you could say, I granted michila by accepting them there. That you could do. But can you create a kinyan, an active kinyan? That you can't do. So even the Chachamim would agree in that case it's not binding. There's another view in Sanhedrin that by the case of michila, everybody agrees that you can be mochel. The machlok between the Chachamim and Rabbi Meir is in a case of latet, where he actively says, can you engage? The question is, can that be binding without a kinyan? Do you have a right to create this binding type of agreement even when there's no kinyan over there? Rabbi Meir says you can back out of it. There's no binding agreement. There was no kinyan over here. So even though Rabbi Meir says you can be koned davar shelo bali olam, that's if you have a kinyan. Here you don't have a kinyan, it's not binding. The Chachamim say, despite the fact that there's no kinyan, it's binding over here. So now, what the Gemara says over here, what was the point of the statement Rabbi Ava brought to Rabbi Yosef Bar Chama? What was the point of that statement? What do we learn from it? You learn from it's binding? We already know it's binding from the Mishnah in Sanhedrin. It's Machloket the Chachamim and Rabbi Meir. So why are you bringing me another case where you say if he takes the Shavuah, it's binding? The answer to that question is Kamash Malan. The answer is that it identifies for us which of those two positions in Sanhedrin is correct. Remember we said there was a Machloket as to whether the Machloket Rabbi Meir and the Chachamim is only in a case of Mechila, or is even in a case of Kinyan. What you see here is that we believe that their machloket exists even in the case of Kinyan. Because the case of Ashbev and Otel is a case where he's going to take a Shva and he's going to actively remove the item from the other party. He's not being mochel. He's actively taking it away from the muhzak badavar. So you see that their machloket is in Be'etein Lecha, even in a case where it's going to be granted. And number two, you see the loch is like the Chachamim, that it is binding. So that's what it came to teach you. It came to teach you that the machloket even exists not just by cases of Mechila, but even in cases where you actively have to give something up, you have to disgorge some item because of what their psak is. And number two, it shows you the halacha is like the Chachamim, that it's binding and you can't walk away from it. Now, when can you not walk away from it? That has to do with a little vav over here. The vav, and the first line of the Gemara here, it says, Soncha shvav v'tol, if you want to take a shvav and take it, v'nishba. And he went ahead and took a shvua. The Bali Tosfot, you can see the first line of Tosfot, Perish, im nishbak far, in yocholak zorbo. If he took the shvuah already, he can't back out of it. Because it says, v'nishba, and he took a shvuah, he can't back out of it. So the Vav says that he did take a shvuah. There was an alternate girsa, the Tosfot bring it later on, of a Rashi Perish. Rashi says, even if he didn't take the shvuah yet, it's binding. His girsa in the Gemara was, Ratzoncha shba v'tol, nishba. He has to take a shvuah, not v'nishba, and he took a shvuah, it's binding. Nishba, he must take a shvuah. If he doesn't take the shvuah, he loses his money. So that's the way that Rashi learns it. Here it's a machloket as to whether the binding nature of this is only when you actually do it, meaning only after you take the shvuah, or only after there's a gemar din in the case of the arbitration, or is it binding from that moment that you must now go to this court, and you are bound by their decision. If you refuse to go to the court, you're now a misarev and you lose the case. Or in the case of shvuah, if you have yet to take a shvuah and you agree to accept the shvuah as a way to adjudicate the case, if in the end you don't accept the shvuah, or if the person doesn't take the shvuah, you have no rights anymore because it's a demand that you take a shvuah. If you don't take the shvuah, you're going to lose out. Depending on whether you have the letter vav or don't have the letter vav, has usually implications. As nafkamina da alocha, as to when this becomes binding. Is it binding immediately, once you agree to it? Or is it only binding once action has been taken? Gemar din, shvuah, then it is binding. That's machloket Tosafot and the Rashi. Okay, we're going to stop here by the two dots on the top of Kuf Chav Chet, Amud Aleph.